Welcome to Presenting Alfred Hitchcock Presents, presented by the Ann Arbor District Library. I'm Al Sheridsma, and we're listening right now to Frank Sinatra performing One for My Baby and One More for the Road.
It's quarter to three. There's no one in the place except you and me. So set 'em up, Joe.
Of this song, AmericanSongwriter.com says, the song was written by Harold Arlen and Johnny Mercer, with Mercer allegedly inspired by his torch for Judy Garland, 13 years his younger, and someone with whom he would carry on a long-standing extramarital affair. It originally appeared in 1943 as part of a relatively forgotten Fred Astaire musical, but was longing for the performer who could inhabit the narrator telling his troubles to a bartender right before closing time. Those wee small hours of the morning were always the domain of Frank Sinatra, so it's no surprise that he found the song intriguing. He first took a whack at it in 1947, but it wasn't until 11 years later, on his downcast concept album, Frank Sinatra Sings for Only the Lonely, that he truly claimed it from all other comers. With pianist Bill Miller tinkling away the memories and Nelson Riddle providing the string arrangement to break his fall, Sinatra propped himself up against the bar and gave a performance for the ages. As he remembered, the atmosphere in the studio was exactly like a club. Dave Cavanaugh of Capitol Records said, "Roll 'em." There was one take, and that was that. The only time I've known it to happen like that. One for My Baby and One More for the Road brilliantly hides all the particulars about the relationship that we know is the cause for the narrator's drinking and bargaining. Instead, it plays out as a one-sided conversation, yet one where we can tell Joe the bartender's reactions by the tone of the lyrics, Sinatra's subtle inflections. Joe is benevolent when the drinker confesses, "We're drinking, my friend, to the end of a brief episode." He's reluctantly obliging when asked to tune the jukebox to something easy and sad, and he stands fast and firm when it's understood, "I can tell you a lot, but you've got to be true to your code." The bridge makes a sudden melodic turn as if the narrator believes he has an important point to make. The hackneyed rhyme of "know it" and "poet" betrays the fact that the broken-hearted fool at the bar is starting to feel the effects of his alcohol. But he snaps out of it to reveal what he's really trying to do, a futile attempt to small-talk his way out of a sadness too intense to bear. "And when I'm gloomy, won't you listen to me until it's talked away?" In the final verse, the narrator realizes that his time in the bar is running out, which means that the reality he's been trying to avoid is creeping ever nearer. Sinatra's voice soars out of any hints of inebriation for a moment of vulnerable lucidity when he sings, "But this torch that I found, it's got to be drowned, or it soon might explode."
"But this torch that I found, it's gotta be drowned, or it soon might explode."
Then one last repeat of that eternal toast to lost causes.
"So make it one for my baby and one more for the road."
Sinatra's improvisation at the end, repeating over and over how long the road ahead for his character will prove to be, is one final dagger.
"It's so long, the long, very long,
it's a great song, but it didn't originate the phrase "one for the road." Wherever it comes from, it's a phrase that feels like it has more of a meaning than the obvious. But does it? This is from a blog at firstedit.co.uk. "So I was led to believe that the phrases "one more for the road" and "on the wagon" both came from the long journey from prison to hangman's noose, It has often been claimed that One More for the Road came from the habit of the local inns offering prisoners a final drink on their way to the gallows. Similarly, if the prisoner refused or were refused this final drink, they remained on the wagon. Unfortunately, this appears to be bunkum. It seems we were just not that nice to the condemned, much preferring to jeer and leer than refresh. One for the Road seems to be just a well-used plea to keep your friends together for a little while longer. Don't go yet. Have another one for the road. Oh well, I thought for a second we were getting somewhere. But if that's all it is, it's still a nice title for this episode, much better than the original story's title of Partner in Crime. And it's a line that closes out the episode and the story very nicely. By the way, if you're tired of me playing all those clips from other programs, have I got the episode for you. Here's Hitch. His head and hands are locked into a pillory. If you're not certain what that is, here's the definition from Britannica. An instrument of corporal punishment consisting of a wooden post and frame fixed on a platform raised several feet from the ground. The head and hands of the offender were thrust through holes in the frame so as to be held fast and exposed in front of it.
Good evening. Methinks I should never have come to the colonies. Here I am, the producer's dream, a captive audience. Unfortunately, knowing the producer, I have already seen tonight's story several times. It is called One for the Road. They say there are two sides to every question, but tonight's little problem has three sides, for it is that age-old bit of marital geometry, the eternal triangle.
That's all that my DVD has, but here's the rest, courtesy of the Alfred Hitchcock Presents Companion by Martin Grahams Jr. and Patrick Wickstrom. I suppose you're wondering why I'm a prisoner. If you think we have freedom of speech here, just try speaking your mind about television commercials. But I've learned my lesson. Ladies and gentlemen, may I present my esteemed sponsor, who will give, as a public service, a short and candid appraisal of one of his superb products. So here's One for the Road. First broadcast on March 3rd, 1957. Starring John Barragray, George Ann Johnson, and Louise Platt. Teleplay by Robert C. Dennis, based on a story by Emily Neff, and directed by Robert Stevens. We have met all but one of those people before. This is the second and last appearance for John Barragray after Portrait of Jocelyn, episode 28 of season 1. This is the second of three appearances for George Ann Johnson after Jonathan, episode 10 of season 2. Her next is Night of the Execution, episode 13 of season 3. We've had 12 previous teleplays by Robert C. Dennis, Don't Come Back Alive, Our Cook's a Treasure, Guilty Witness, The Older Sister, The Derelicts, Place of Shadows, Help Wanted, The Orderly World of Mr. Appleby, The Belfry, Crack of Doom, John Brown's Body, and Nightmare in 4D. He has 17 more teleplays in the series. His next is Martha Mason Movie Star, episode 34 of season 2. And this is the third of three episodes based on the stories of Emily Neff, After the Babysitter and Mr. Blanchard's Secret. But she does have an episode of the Alfred Hitchcock Hour, Bed of Roses, episode 29 of season 2. And this is not only the 23rd of 44 Alfred Hitchcock Presents and 5 Alfred Hitchcock Hour episodes for director Robert Stevens, but it's also his third in a row. His previous directing work was on Premonition, Our Cook's a Treasure, Guilty Witness, The Cheney Vase, You Got to Have Luck, The Older Sister, Shopping for Death, Place of Shadows, The Perfect Murder, Portrait of Jocelyn, Never Again, The Gentleman from America, The Babysitter, The Hidden Thing, Momentum, De Mortuis.
De Mortuis.
De Mortuis.
De Mortuis.
None Are So Blind, Toby, John Brown's Body, The Manacled, Number 22, and The End of Indian Summer. He's going to break his streak of consecutive episodes, but then he'll be back in the one right after that. I Killed the Count, Part 1, Episode 25 of Season 2. If I hadn't already told you that Robert Stevens was the director, you could probably figure it out by the opening shot. It's a classic Stevens close-up, this time of a sugar bowl and a cup of coffee. A hand holding a spoon enters the frame and adds 2 spoonfuls of sugar to the coffee, stirring it in. Little do we know that this is the most important close-up of the episode, because it is giving us a glimpse into the ending right from the start. As the hand picks up the cup of coffee, we cut from a close shot to a long shot of a man having breakfast in the kitchen, while behind, through the kitchen door and a bedroom door, we see his wife packing his suitcase. He is Charles Hendricks, played by John Barragray, and she is Marcia Hendricks, played by Louise Platt. He calls to her, wondering what's become of his cigarettes. She tells him she has opened a new pack, which she has on her person. She walks over from the bedroom to the kitchen, taps the pack so that the cigarettes stick out, and sits with him at the table. He takes a cigarette from the pack, and she lights it for him. He hasn't had to move a muscle, and the smile on her face and the look of love in her eyes gives us a sense that she does this sort of thing for him all the time.
Your bag's all packed.
Good.
I put in only 3 shirts for you this time. The last few trips, you haven't worn the 4th.
Well, it's been cooler.
They get so crushed, they have to be laundered anyway, but if you think you'll need the 4th...
Well, I'll see how it works out. Well, have I got time for another piece of coffee cake?
Uh-uh. It's not good for you. We have to be careful of your diet.
That's what I get for marrying a nurse. Can I bring anything this trip?
I've got everything, at least for half the week.
A rather nice way to let us know through dialogue that Marcia's a nurse, something that will be important a little later. He gets up and goes into the bedroom. She follows and helps to adjust his tie when they get there.
Let me, darling.
Oh?
I wish you didn't have to go out on the road.
It's only for 3 days, darling. You ought to be used to it by this time. Now, where's my coat?
Right here.
She goes to get his coat and helps him on with it. She then goes over to the bureau and picks up his wallet, handkerchief, some other things, and hands them to him as they converse. So if there's one thing we've learned, it's that Marcia does everything to make things easier for Charles. We have a 2-shot of them over by the bureau until he moves away, setting up a very nice shot, once again using Robert Stevens' predilection toward close-ups of objects.
Say, that reminds me. Don't we have an anniversary coming up next week?
Mm-hmm.
Which one is it? 4th? 5th?
You know very well it's the 11th.
No. Well, if a package comes while I'm away, no fair peeking. Have I got everything?
Mm-hmm. No. You might return this to your lady friend.
The camera has followed Charles away from her, but when she gives that last line, her hand enters the frame, holding a cigarette lighter in the foreground.
Where'd you get that?
Your gray suit.
It must be my secretary's. I'm always borrowing hers.
Those are not Miss Englewood's initials.
He has taken it from her, and we now get a close-up of it in the palm of his hand, and we can see the initials B.A. If only B.A. had lit all his cigarettes for him, as Marcia seems to do, so that he wouldn't have had to pick up her lighter.
Well, I'll be darned if I know where I got it. I'm in a dozen offices every day.
Now try to think, what do the letters B.A. stand for?
Bachelor of Arts.
He kisses her, and she wraps her arms around his neck as he does so. Then he heads off on the road, whereupon we dissolve to a shot of George Ann Johnson holding a drink in each hand.
Now tell me if that's too dry.
She reaches down with one drink, and the camera follows down to Charles reclining on the couch and receiving the drink from her. So he has two different women babying him. But George Ann, playing Beryl Abbott, B.A., is aware of Marcia and aware that Charles is married to her.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could be together like this every night?
Oh, I don't know. Might be too much of a good thing.
Speak for yourself.
They say the best romances are those with obstacles. Add spice.
Oh. Oh, marriage doesn't have to be so dull. Oh, I bet ours wouldn't be.
Are we getting married? Penalty for bigamy is pretty severe, I'm told.
Well, darling, hasn't it ever occurred to you that... well, you could divorce Marcia.
No. She's a better cook than you are. Makes wonderful coffee.
That line, if we didn't already know it by the fact that he's playing around, lets us know that Charles is a grade-A crumb. But note also, he references coffee again. This conversation has moved from the couch over to the kitchen, and after Beryl laughs it off...
Oh, you're not being serious.
She picks up a dish of what looks like celery and olives and takes it over to the table. The camera follows her, allowing Robert Stevens to give us a duplication of the previous scene in which Charles was on camera and Marcia's hand held out the lighter. Now it's Beryl who is on camera, with Charles's hand holding out the lighter.
She found this in one of my suits.
Beryl takes the lighter from him, just as Charles took the lighter from Marcia.
How'd you explain it?
I didn't have to explain it. Marcia isn't a jealous woman.
Charles enters the frame with that line.
I'm sorry. I guess it's just that I love you.
Love you.
They embrace, and the camera moves in on Beryl's face, looking a bit troubled, and dissolves then very nicely to Marcia's face, which is of the same size and in the same position as Beryl's was. Marcia may baby Charles relentlessly, but it appears that she doesn't necessarily obey him. It wasn't too long ago that he told her,
"Well, if a package comes while I'm away, no fair peeking."
Now we find Marcia smiling and reading a note, and then the camera pans down to show us that she has opened the package. She then pulls out a vase, discovering, much to her disappointment, that part of it has broken off. Seeing this, she puts it back in the box and goes over to the phone, and that's when her troubles really begin.
Hello, Miss Inglewood. This is Mrs. Hendricks. Yes, I know he's out of town. That's why I'm calling you. I have to get in touch with him. Where in Lockton? Well, haven't you a number where he can be reached? Yes, it is an emergency. 182. Yes, I have it, Miss Inglewood. Thank you. Lockton, 182, please.
Marcia has written 182 on a piece of paper, and then she doodles as she dials. We get a close-up of that paper.
Hello?
Hello, who's this?
Well, this is Beryl. Beryl Abbott.
Well, I was given this number to reach Mr. Charles Hendricks.
Well, there isn't anyone here by that name, I'm afraid. You must have the wrong number.
Oh, I'm sorry.
When Beryl gives her name, Marcia writes that down, and just as she's about to call Miss Inglewood back, we get a close-up of that paper again. In that close-up, we see her circle the B and the A, which makes her hang up the phone and gives her pause for thought. This seems like a good time to look at Louise Platt, who plays Marcia. This is from an article in the Zanesville, Ohio, Sunday Times Signal from November 26, 1950, entitled "Lovely Stage Star Saw World as Child of Navy Surgeon." As a daughter of a Navy surgeon whose transfers brought him halfway around the world, Louise acquired a valuable education, traveling from station to station, or, as she puts it, hopscotching the naval bases. Home to her could have been China, the Philippines, or the West Indies, all of which were her wonderland at one time or another. Louise was ushered into the theater by a teacher who insisted that she must appear in a school play in order to obtain the necessary credits for graduation. Although disturbed at the thought of facing an audience, Louise was cordially received in her debut. So gratified and thrilled was she with the response that she abandoned plans for a college degree and prepared herself for the stage, bound for a career on Broadway. In her obituary at independent.co.uk, Tom Valance writes, "Following several seasons with repertory companies, she made her Broadway debut in Philip Barry's short-lived comedy Spring Dance, 1936, having replaced Imogene Coca during a summer tryout. The play's producer-director was Jed Harris, a colorful and controversial figure, one of the most talented and hated men in show business, whose romantic conquests were many. When Platt became his lover, she was succeeding Katharine Hepburn and Margaret Sullivan. Harris had become a Broadway legend when, at the age of 28, he produced 4 straight smash hits in the space of 18 months, a feat never again matched on Broadway. Though regarded by many as a genius, he was also known for his rages, his feuds, and his disrespectful treatment of women. When Platt went to Hollywood after appearing in 2 more Broadway failures, Harris pursued her, and after a stormy courtship, they were finally married in Mexico City. On the journey back to California," said Platt, "he told her he was sorry he had married her. When we did Spring Dance, he was even-tempered, really brilliant," she told the author Martin Gottfried. "He could control his temper, he could deal with people, but when things began to dry up and more people turned against him, that was when his quest for power over people became frightening. Platt became petrified of her husband, though she said his violence was usually directed at objects, hurling ashtrays or kicking out windows. By the time Platt had their daughter in 1941, they were divorced. The birth of the child brought them together again for a time, despite the abuse Platt suffered. Louise adored Jed," said her friend Doris Johnson, wife of the writer Nunnally Johnson. "She was almost worshipful." 40 years later, her memories of Harris were so painful that she had him scissored out of all the snapshots in her scrapbooks. Now, when Louise went to Hollywood in 1936, she was one of the first actresses to be screen-tested for the role of Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind. This is from an article by Paul Harrison in the Salt Lake City Telegram of June 12, 1940, entitled "Louise Platt Climbs on Play Flops." She made a brief photographic test for the top part in Gone with the Wind and showed up favorably, but then flunked her audition before George Cukor. After striking an attitude to begin a scene, Miss Platt stalled on the first syllable. But producer Walter Wanger later happened to see her silent screen test. He brought her here for the second feminine lead in I Met My Love Again. That film starred Henry Fonda and Joan Bennett, and she appeared again with Henry Fonda in the film Spawn of the North. After that came her best-known role as the pregnant wife of a cavalry officer in John Ford's Stagecoach.
"Where's the cavalry, Chris?"
Where's the soldiers?"
"There ain't no soldiers."
"Huh?
Soldiers are gone."
"Where's Captain Mallory? Where's my husband? Where is he?"
"You, his wife, I think?"
"Yes, where is he? Did he go with his men?"
"Si, senora. Little what you call a skirmish with the Apaches last night. Soldiers take Captain Morales to Lordsburg. I think he get hurt, maybe."
"Badly?"
"Si, senora. I think so."
"Mrs. Mallory, I'm awfully sorry. If there's anything I can..."
"Quite all right, thank you."
This is Tom Valance in The Independent again. After her sterling work in Stagecoach, Jed Harris then asked his friend, the writer Ed Chodorov, to use his influence at MGM on her behalf. The result was a starring role opposite Melvin Douglas in Tell No Tales, 1939, a fast-paced melodrama in which she played the witness to a kidnapping. The film failed to propel her to the front ranks, however, and her film career petered out in three B-movies. Her last film, Street of Chance, 1942, was one of her finest, an intriguing early film noir in which an amnesiac, played by Burgess Meredith, desperately tries to discover his identity and clarify his involvement in a murder. Platt returned to the New York stage in Five Alarm Waltz, a four-performance flop, directed by Harris, and notable only as the last play in which Elia Kazan appeared as an actor. Kazan later wrote of Harris's abominable treatment of Platt. He had her, he recalled, completely beaten down. After retiring to bring up her daughter, she returned to Broadway in her only hit show, Maxwell Anderson's Anne of the Thousand Days, 1948, in which she played Anne Boleyn's sister Mary. Her final play was produced and directed by Harris. Herman Wouk's The Traitor, 1949, was a downbeat Cold War thriller that took in such subjects as atom bomb secrets, communism, academic freedom, and Soviet-U.S. relations. Though Variety considered it tautly written, superbly produced, and convincingly performed, it closed after 67 performances. Platt ended her acting career with television work in the 50s. From 1958 to 1959, she had a recurring role in the soap opera, The Guiding Light. Now, Tom Valance ends his obituary with this paragraph. She separated for good from Harris in the late 40s. A novel by Frederick Wakeman, published in 1947 and later filmed, The Saxon Charm, is purportedly based on Harris, with one of the women in his life a combination of Platt and Rosamund Pinchot, a former socialite who committed suicide because of him. Platt married again in the 1950s to Stanley Gould, a quiet academic, who was Jed Harris's stage manager. Paul Harrison began and ended his 1940 article on Louise like this. Louise Platt is a leading lady who doesn't own an evening dress. That should give you some idea of her seriousness, but it omits the important fact that Miss Platt also laughs a great deal, and usually at herself. They'll tell you on the lot that she's a strange gal, serious and earnestly argumentative, and unfortunately too busy for romance, but swell. Louise Platt died in 2003 at the age of 88. This is her first of two Alfred Hitchcock Presents appearances. Her next and last is Dip in the Pool, episode 35 of season 3. Back to our episode, where Charles is in the bathroom in his pajamas, his pajama top unbuttoned, looking quite sexy, with Marcia in the bedroom, sitting on the bed.
Well, I'll just have it replaced, sweetheart. There's nothing to get so upset about.
But I was upset terribly. I'm not superstitious or anything, but to see my anniversary present broken, it seemed like an omen. I was sure that something had happened.
Or maybe, because the broken vase leads her to Beryl Abbott, something is going to happen.
Well, I'm back, safe and sound.
That's why I tried to telephone you.
The shot has alternated between Charles and Marcia until this point. And now the camera stays on Charles as he buttons up his pajama top and his face reacts to this news.
You. But you knew I wasn't at the office.
Miss Englewood gave me a number to call and lock them.
At this point, Marcia comes to the door and joins Charles in the shot.
Charles? Who is Beryl Abbott?
I'm Slice's idea.
That isn't true. She answered the phone.
Well, I don't know what number Miss Englewood gave you, but it was obviously the wrong one. When I'm in Lofton, I always stay at the Willow Hotel.
Don't lie to me, Charles. That cigarette lighter was hers, and those initials were hers. You've been carrying on with this Beryl Abbott. It's true, isn't it?
I won't have you checking up on me. Suppose I happen to see a woman in Lofton. What of it?
I think I already mentioned that Charles is a grade A crumb, and after admitting that he's seen another woman and that he won't stand for his wife checking up on him, he leaves the bathroom and the frame, leaving Marcia alone, looking heartbroken. And again, we dissolve from one woman to the other. But before we join Beryl, I'd like to point out that these two, Beryl and Charles, could have done a much better job of concealing their affair if they'd bothered to. First of all, what is Charles doing with Beryl's cigarette lighter? Wouldn't you think he'd be a little more careful about what he brings into the house? Then Beryl gives her full name to a perfect stranger over the telephone. Charles has given his secretary, Miss Inglewood, Beryl's phone number, and he claims to Marcia that he always stays at the Willow Hotel. But he doesn't keep a room at the hotel, and he doesn't tell the people there to take messages for him in case Marcia happened to call the hotel. So this is my bit of advice to anyone planning an extramarital affair. Don't do this stuff. Now, the camera initially focuses just on Beryl as we make that dissolve, but Charles is there, pouring himself a drink. He has told her about his conversation with Marcia, and she wonders how he got out of it.
It's kind of ticklish for a moment. My secretary has this number in case the office has to get in touch with me. She wasn't supposed to give it out, but she didn't think that applied to my wife.
What did you tell her?
Told her I wouldn't see you anymore.
You didn't really mean that, did you?
Again, the camera has gone back and forth between Beryl and Charles, but here Beryl leaves her single shot and joins Charles in his to make it a two shot.
What do you think? Just the same, I think you ought to change your phone number.
Yeah, and maybe she should move, too, while she's at it. Anything else you want, Charles?
All right, I'll get an unlisted one tomorrow.
Good idea.
Just the same, if we were married, we wouldn't have to worry about other people.
Now, you're not going to start that again, are you?
Well, you might think about it.
All right. I've thought about it.
And?
This arrangement suits me just fine.
Now we dissolve to Charles and Marcia's bedroom. They sleep in separate beds, of course, since it's 1950s television. Charles is in the foreground, reading a book. Marcia in the background, turned on her side, staring at him. When he finishes his reading, he says goodnight to her and turns away from her so that they are both facing us. We stay with this shot for quite a while as Marcia opens the conversation by telling him,
"You lied to me. You're still seeing that woman. Lipstick all over your shirt."
More advice to those planning an extramarital affair. Don't leave the lipstick on your shirt. Well, Charles can't deny that, but instead of coming clean, he lets Marcia believe that he is trying to break it off, but that Beryl is threatening him with a scandal.
She can make it seem a lot worse than it ever was. I'd lose my job, of course. I could move to another city and start again. It's you I'm worried about.
It's only at this point that Charles actually turns enough to look at her. She tells him not to worry, that everything's going to be all right. He says he doesn't deserve her and wishes her good night. And it's only then that the shot changes to a close-up of Marcia lying in bed, looking up at the ceiling.
Darling. Would you mind taking the bus to the office tomorrow? I think I'd like to have the car. I want to do some shopping.
Of course you can have the car.
When he tells her she can have the car, only her eyes move, shifting stage right to look at him. And then we get another one of those dissolves of her face in bed, almost perfectly matched with her face as she drives the car. We get a shot of the car as it passes a sign for locked in city limits. And then we get a close-up of a doorbell as her hand comes in to press it. The camera pans up to show us Marcia at Beryl's door, and then it pans down to show her purse, and it's time for the commercial. Beryl answers the door, and we get a two-shot of the two women facing each other. But Marcia doesn't tell her who she is. She comes out with a story.
I'm from the Welfare Association. I'm collecting old clothes.
Oh, yes. Well, I'm afraid that I don't have any old clothes.
Anything at all will do, no matter how old the clothes are.
No, you see, I don't keep any old clothes.
But it's such a worthy cause. Surely you have something that you'll never wear again.
Well, I'll tell you, I'll see what I have in that back closet if you'll just come back later, all right?
I don't mind waiting. It's no trouble, really.
All right, just be a minute.
Beryl goes inside, leaving Marcia on the stoop, but Marcia pushes the door open. The camera switches from outside to inside as Marcia enters, and we get a close-up of a sugar bowl from Marcia's point of view, sitting on the kitchen counter. She pulls a small envelope out of her purse. It's filled with a white powder that she pours into the sugar bowl, shaking it just slightly to try to mix it with the sugar. And then she starts to head out of the kitchen, only to be caught by Beryl, who has come out with a couple of articles of clothing. Her excuse...
I was just admiring your kitchen.
...says nothing about why she's actually entered the house. Marcia professes to admire several things about Beryl's home, including her couch.
I'm thinking of buying a new divan. May I ask how much this one cost?
Well, I really have no idea.
Which seems to indicate that someone has bought it for her. We get a close-up, again from Marcia's point of view, of a photograph of Charles sitting on Beryl's coffee table. It's the photograph sitting on Beryl's coffee table, not Charles in the photograph sitting on Beryl's coffee table. And then Beryl gives Marcia the clothes, one of which is a man's raincoat that Marcia probably recognizes.
Here's an old raincoat. Now, maybe some man can use that.
Your husband must be a tall man.
Yes, he is.
I have trouble keeping mine on a diet. Do you have that problem?
No, I'm afraid that I rather indulge mine.
They both look down at the photograph, and then Marcia beats a hasty retreat, leaving the shot so that we have Beryl alone, dissolving to Marcia alone, asleep in a chair. The phone rings, waking her up. And when she answers, it's Miss Inglewood, whose voice we actually hear this time, but who goes uncredited at the end of the show.
Hello?
Mrs. Hendricks?
Yes?
This is Miss Inglewood down at the office. I've been trying to reach you all afternoon.
Yes. I went shopping.
Your husband asked me to let you know he was called out of town.
But he couldn't have. He left the car at home.
Yes, I know. He took a company car. He said it would be rather late, Mrs. Hendricks. He had to go all the way to Lockton.
Lockton.
Mrs. Hendricks, are you all right?
Yes, Miss Inglewood, I'm quite all right.
As Marcia realizes what that means, we dissolve again from one woman to the other. Beryl has her back to us. It looks like she's doing the dishes when someone enters. It's Charles, whom we only see from the back to start.
Well, what a pleasant surprise. Is there something wrong? I mean, you're 3 days early.
Beryl, there's something we've got to discuss. Marcia's being very difficult. I thought I could smooth it over, but I couldn't.
Well, I suppose it had to come to a choice sooner or later.
I'm glad you're taking it so well.
Oh. So Marcia wins.
Well, after all, I'm married to her.
Sure, it wasn't any contest at all, was it?
I thought if we didn't see each other for a while, a few months, just long enough to satisfy Marcia, then We could pick up where we left off.
Well, how very clever of you to work it out so neatly.
Now, don't be like that, darling.
I'm sorry. I understand.
I'll miss you, of course. You know that. Might not be as long as we think.
Or it might be a little bit longer. We now crossfade to Marcia's car as it speeds up to Beryl's house and stops with a screech. Since she's in a 50s television program, just like Steve Forrest as Joe Rogers last time, she climbs across and gets out of the car through the passenger door. Then she buzzes the doorbell and knocks with both fists until Beryl answers.
Where is he? Is he all right?
What are you talking about?
I'm Marcia Hendricks. Where's Charles?
You're his wife.
I put something in the sugar bowl this afternoon.
What do you mean?
It's poison. I got it from the hospital where I used to work.
Remember this foreshadowing from the first few minutes of the episode?
That's what I get for marrying a nurse.
Marcia has entered, and at first we get a two-shot of the women. But after she admits putting the poison in the sugar bowl, the camera moves into Beryl alone, and it zeroes slowly into her throughout Marcia's explanation.
You were trying to poison me.
I never dreamed that Charles would come here today. I tried to telephone you. Then I drove just as fast as I could to get here in time.
Mrs. Hendricks, you didn't get here in time.
With that, the camera switches back to Marcia. Beryl, shortly after, joining her in the frame.
You know Charles and his coffee? Exactly 2 teaspoons full for every cup. I sat there and watched him do it. I had no idea it was poisoned.
Where is he?
Well, he left here about an hour ago.
We have to find him. We have to get him to a doctor. I'll go to the police.
If you go to the police, you'll have to tell them how Charles got that poison.
I'm going to the police.
Mrs. Hendricks, if he's dead, you're a murderess.
Nothing matters except Charles.
With that, Marcia leaves the frame and the house, and seconds later, Charles enters the room.
Who was it?
Oh, just some woman from the Welfare Association, collecting old clothes.
Oh? Maybe it's just as well we're calling it off. I'm getting mighty tired of hiding every time that doorbell rings.
And in their ensuing conversation, Charles says various things that make Beryl feel that she still has a chance with him. Things like...
I'd give anything if it didn't have to be this way.
But in the end...
Are you sure you don't want a divorce, Marcia?
I'm afraid that's out of the question.
Now, as this scene proceeds, we start to realize that that slow close-up of Beryl, when she learned about the poison, allowed her to think about possibly using that poison. If the creeping close-up wasn't enough, we have her saying things like,
"Well, your troubles will soon be over."
And now we get a close-up of the coffee pot as she's heating it, and the sugar bowl, and the cups of coffee as she fills them. And we get a nice running close-up shot following that tray as she brings it over to Charles.
Haven't you got time for a cup of coffee with...
An old friend, of whom I'll always be very fond.
I hope you always will. How about one for the road? With an old friend.
Why not? One for the road.
And we return to a version of the shot with which we started the episode. A close-up of the sugar bowl and the cup of coffee as Charles, spoon in hand, takes 2 heaping teaspoons for the road. A few things here. First of all, in spite of Hitch's retribution outro, I don't see any reason why Beryl would be suspected of anything here. It was Marcia who put the poison in the sugar, and if we can believe her, she's going to go to the police and admit to it. As far as she or anyone else knows, Charles already drank that poison and is on the road. Of course, we don't know what's going to happen with Charles and his body after the end of the episode. And speaking of Charles and his body, where does he keep his car when he visits Beryl? He's not on the street in front of her house, or Marcia would have noticed that. Wherever it is, it's too bad he didn't leave it on the street this time, seeing as he wasn't planning to stay particularly long. And finally, you'll notice that Michael Kuhn, whom we saw in our previous episode as the bellboy, gets a credit here at the end. Now, since it's pretty obviously a three-character play, I'm pretty sure that Michael's not in here, unless, of course, he is the voice of Miss Inglewood. But don't worry, we will see Michael one more time in Vicious Circle, episode 29 of season 2. As I mentioned, Emily Neff's story is entitled Partner in Crime. It's a taut little thriller that is very much like the episode, though because it's prose, it has the added advantage of letting us in on the character's feelings. For example, on the very first page, we learn of Marcia that she had never wholly recovered from the compliment of his having married her in the first place. She was sweet-faced but plain, cheerful but prosaic, and the feat of winning Charles Hendricks when any number of prettier, cleverer girls were swooning over him was a supreme achievement of her existence. As in the episode, she finds a cigarette lighter with the initials B.A., only here Charles tells her a few days later that he has tracked it down and it belonged to a female buyer in Hadley. She has knock knees and a hooked nose. So Marcia forgets about it until she finds a note in the wastebasket. She was emptying the trash when a crumpled piece of blue writing paper caught her eye. Afraid that it was a letter she had forgotten to answer, she opened it out. Charles, it read, pick me up at the hairdresser's about 4. B. Marcia finds out that Charles is no longer staying at the Willow Hotel, and then the story shifts to Charles and Beryl, with Beryl asking Charles to divorce Marcia. I don't see how you can expect me to go on like this, living on the scraps of love you dole out. I don't expect you to do a damn thing, Charles said evenly, finishing his drink and standing up. This time she knew she had gone too far. Charles Hendricks had come into her life at a time when widowhood in the small prim town was becoming unendurable, and she had passed the age when remarriage or even a casual romance was the expected thing. She was a fool to force matters. I'm sorry, darling, she said, putting her arms around him. It's just that I love you so terribly. He stroked her hair. Tired of being a Wednesday wife, he murmured. Of course not, she said lightly. But she was. She wanted him all to herself, and the day would come, she was confident, when she would have him. In the meantime, be grateful for small favors. And after that glimpse into Beryl, we get a glimpse into Charles. Charles thought about Beryl Abbott and wondered if he was getting too involved. Involvement was the one thing he dreaded, and so far he had managed to avoid it. He had no sympathy with the men who got themselves enmeshed in scandal and emotional demonstrations. Of course, he was lucky. Marcia was unbelievably trusting, almost naive. But he had always been prudent, confining his amours to other towns and keeping their relationships casual and brief. This business with Beryl was the most nearly serious of any, and he still wondered about the wisdom of giving up his room at the Willow. She was a fascinating woman, there was no denying it, but she was getting too possessive, too demanding. He would have to watch his step. When Marcia finally confronts Charles, they have this conversation. Please don't lie to me, Charles. I can't bear it. I know it's true. Infuriated by her absolute conviction, he said, very well, it's true. There it was. She had brought it out into the open. Now what? What about us? She asked. Nothing's changed, he said with exasperation. Not a thing. I see Beryl now and then. It's a thing men do, Marcia. It's not important. Not important? Of course not. Sometimes you remind me of a little girl, he said, trying to put his arm around her. I've been a good husband to you, haven't I? I don't know. He raised his voice, and Marcia was suddenly frightened. Damn it, I can't stand a jealous woman. I won't have you checking on me. All right, Charles, she said dully. I'm sorry this had to happen, he said more gently. Believe me, you're exaggerating things. But I'll stop seeing her if you want. Satisfied? But Charles did not stop seeing Beryl Abbott, Marcia knew it. It was as if all her senses were heightened, and she fancied she smelled perfume on his clothes, caught a faraway look in his eyes, guessed that his thoughts, when he kissed her, were on someone else. Their life together, which had always seemed so perfect, had suddenly crumbled into a travesty of marriage. It would have helped if Marcia had had something to distract her, but she was essentially domestic and had never gone in for clubs and hobbies. Her whole being was focused on Charles, and his infidelity assumed a gigantic proportion in her eyes. And on the very next page, Marcia Hendricks was not the type to keep up a brave front. She was completely transparent and went about her tasks with a brooding, miserable air. When Charles was at home, she was subdued and ill at ease. When he was away, she was in torment. She longed desperately to regain her trust in him, but it was like a broken vessel which can be patched up but not repaired. She made a sincere effort to believe him, but the doubt was there. Was he still seeing that woman? Was he lying to her? Had there been others? Sick of her hangdog look, her utter dispiritedness, Charles stopped trying to deceive her. He could not stand her expression of disillusion and frank defeat every time he spoke to her. He grew surly, blunt. "Think what you like," he told her. "I'm no tin god, and it's time you learned it." Marcia, through some curious female alchemy, gradually transferred the entire blame to Beryl Abbott. Beryl became, in her mind, the seductress, the arch-rival, while Charles became the victim. Not wholly innocent, perhaps, but helplessly ensnared. So Marcia goes to Beryl's home, claims to represent the homemaker's helper, and that she has a free introductory offer. "I'd like to demonstrate it, if I may." "Really, I don't. It grinds, shreds, and grates," Marcia insisted. "It's very simple, and it's absolutely free." Beryl shrugged. "Very well, if it means so much to you." She held the door open. "It won't take long, will it?" "Just a few seconds," Marcia said. She unwrapped her bundle and screwed the homemaker's helper, purchased from a store at home, onto a surface near the stove. "You plug it in like this," she explained. "Then you slide this piece out. Do you have a carrot or a potato? I'll show how it operates." "Carrot?" Beryl said vaguely. She opened the refrigerator, and it took only the few seconds that her back was turned for Marcia to lift the lid of the coffee pot and drop in the deadly powder. Then all proceeds as the episode does, and the story finishes like this. Marcia pushed her way in and grasped the other woman's arms. "Where is he?" she demanded. "Did he drink it? Is he all right?" "You must be mad," Beryl said sharply. "Who are you?" For the first time, Marcia thought of how she must appear. She still wore her kitchen apron, and her hair was disheveled. "I'm Marcia Hendricks," she said, suspended by Beryl's contained manner. "I've seen you before." "Yes, today. I put something in the coffee when I was in your kitchen." "Oh, please, is he all right?" Beryl looked curiously at her lover's wife. "You meant to poison me?" Apparently they had one thing in common. They both wanted all or nothing. "I hated you. I didn't dream he'd come here today." Beryl's face was impassive. "You're too late." Marcia suddenly crumpled. She had known it. She had known every minute of that nightmarish ride that she would be too late. "Where is he?" she demanded. "He's gone. He left about half an hour ago. I thought he looked strange after he drank the coffee." "But we must find him," Marcia cried. "We must get him to a hospital." She knew that it would take a miracle to reach him in time. The poison was a swift one. "So your plan misfired," Beryl said quietly. Marcia raised her grief-stricken face. "How can you be so cold?" she marveled. "I thought you loved him." "Loved him?" Beryl echoed. "You will never know how much I loved him." "Then come with me," Marcia begged. "Where are you going?" Beryl asked sharply. "To the police, of course. They can help me." "Help you?" Beryl looked at her with something like admiration. "They'll hold you for murder." Marcia pulled away frantically. What difference could that possibly make now? What difference indeed? "You go," Beryl said in a gentler tone. "It would be better if I stay here. I can't help you now." She watched Marcia stumble down the walk and get into the car. Then she closed the door and stood a moment with her back to it. At last she walked to the foot of the stairs and called up. "Charles! Charles, it's all right now." He came down swiftly, looking annoyed. "Who was it?" he asked. "You don't know how sick I am of hiding every time someone comes to see you." "I don't blame you, darling," Beryl said softly. "But you won't have to hide any more, will you? You'll be safe at home with your precious Marcia." "I'm sorry," Charles said. "I'm truly sorry, Beryl." She moved very close to him. Are you sure, quite sure, you won't reconsider? Let's not go through it all again, he said impatiently. Very well, she said lightly. But let's not part enemies, darling. At least have a cup of coffee with me, won't you? One for the road? When we last left Hitch, in our history of his silent films, he had just moved over to British International Pictures, and they gave him the opportunity to choose his next subject. What he chose was boxing for his film entitled The Ring. In The Dark Side of Genius, The Life of Alfred Hitchcock, Donald Spoto quotes Hitch as saying, I think the thing, strangely enough, that fascinated me about boxing in those days was the English audience that would go all dressed up in black tie to sit around the ring. Spoto goes on to say, and in the film, he stressed just such odd and ironic juxtapositions, simultaneously showing his fascination for the grotesque, his interest in freaks and freakishness, his increasing reliance on purely cinematic devices, blurred images and distorted montages, and his maintenance of the thematic and structural ambiguity of the title, Boxing Ring and Wedding Ring, all recall Hitchcock's exposure to the German school of filmmaking. The Ring was Hitchcock's first original screenplay, and the executives at BIP were astonished at its careful symmetry, its economy of storytelling means, and its psychological sophistication. And since it was a silent film, Hitchcock was able to display what was always his strongest talent, his ability to use strictly visual means to tell the story. Now, the opening credits do say, written and directed by Alfred Hitchcock, the only time Hitch ever took a solo writing credit. But Patrick McGilligan, in Alfred Hitchcock, A Life in Darkness and Light, notes that the film was first mentioned in the trades in April 27th. By then, a draft of the script had already been completed. Elliot Stannard was reported as the writer, and Stannard's name was cited again as late as 1 week before photography commenced. But when Hitchcock and Stannard had a falling out, Walter Mycroft, the newspaper man associated with the Evening Standard, was brought in for touch-ups and technical advice on the boxing sequences. The director also knew boxing. He could discourse knowledgeably on both the rules and the fighters, and routinely attended soccer and tennis, as well as boxing matches. The film begins at a carnival with a sideshow, and in his book Hitch, The Life and Times of Alfred Hitchcock, John Russell Taylor notes, the tawdry sideshows, among which the early scenes are set, represented another aspect of that seamy underside of show business which had always fascinated Hitch, and did give him the chance to show with vivid location reality a whole spectrum of lower-class English life, which at that time had rarely, if ever, been seen on the screen. Here's a synopsis of the film, courtesy of Patrick McGilligan. The first act of The Ring takes place against the backdrop of a fairground, where one round jack, an amateur pugilist, takes on all comers. A nattily dressed stranger flirts with Mabel, a comely ticket taker, and then decides to fight Jack. Mabel roots for Jack, who is her boyfriend, but Jack is beaten by the natty newcomer. The winner is revealed as the Australian heavyweight champion Bob Corby. With one eye on Mabel, Bob invites Jack to take a job with him as a sparring partner and train professionally. The story then shifts to Hitchcock's own East End. After winning his first professional match, Jack marries Mabel and his fortunes rise. But his pride is dampened when he sees Bob aggressively wooing his wife at wild parties. Jack's jealousy leads to friction with Bob and a violent confrontation with Mabel. Just as he and Bob finally are matched for a championship bout, Mabel leaves Jack. On the night of the showdown, Mabel is among the crowd. The audience must wait to see who will triumph. Now, in the opening credits, Mabel is only listed as the girl. We only learn her name from a telegram that Jack sends, telling her that he won his test fight to become Corby's sparring partner and that they can get married. McGilligan says that, starting out at the new studio, Hitchcock had more leverage with the casting. He handpicked his lead actress, Lillian Hall Davis, whom Hitchcock had admired as far back as The Passionate Adventure. An amazing girl, he once said of her. On the set, she suffered from an acute self-consciousness, but in private life, she possessed a terrific personality and amazing vivacity. The actress was against type in his canon, a brunette, playing a good-hearted, salt-of-the-earth character. As One Round Jack, the director cast Carl Brisson, a former Danish middleweight champion turned musical comedy entertainer. Brisson's only previous appearance on the screen had been in an obscure Danish picture. Hitchcock could thus claim to have launched Brisson into film, and this would be the more appealing of two leads Brisson would play for him. He also appears in The Manx Man. Ian Hunter, from Downhill and Easy Virtue, was chosen to play Bob Corby, while Gordon Harker, who had begun his long career as a stage prompter in 1902, turned up as Jack's trainer and friend to the last. The son of Joseph C. Harker, a well-known stage scenic artist, Harker was a true Cockney. He had played cheeky Cockneys in Edgar Wallace plays and would supply similar comedy in several Hitchcock BIP films, specifically in Hitchcock's next two films, The Farmer's Wife and Champagne. Patrick McGilligan goes on to write, "It may or may not be true that Claude McDonald was slated to photograph The Ring before illness felled him, or that McDonald bucked about his salary and quit the production at the 11th hour. Certainly it is not true, no matter what the director told Peter Bogdanovich, that Hitchcock taught photography to the 11th hour replacement, John Jaffrey Cox, known as Jack, or that before The Ring, Cox was any kind of second cameraman. Cox was an effects cameraman, an expert in blurred images, overlays, dissolves, and double exposures. That was more important to Hitchcock than framing or lighting genius. Hitchcock really didn't need compositional advice. His staging within the frame was always strongly in his mind and annotated in the script. What Hitchcock wanted was a cameraman who would take a dare, and even veterans like Cox were sometimes taken aback by Hitchcock's taunts and demands. For the film's first fight scene, which takes place under a fairgrounds tent, Hitchcock insisted that Cox remove the usual array of clegs and shoot the bout from a distance, with the only lighting a solitary bulb dangling over the ring. Not only that, he wanted the camera's point of view, Mabel's subjective point of view from outside a gap in the tent, heavily obstructed. In the foreground, shadowed figures in the crowd watch the fight, and like Mabel, the movie audience is forced to peer at the action as if through a long-lens keyhole. Starting with The Ring, Cox would photograph all 10 of Hitchcock's BIP films during the prolific years between 1927 and 1932. Then, after an interval of several years, they would reunite on The Lady Vanishes, 11 Hitchcock pictures. Only Robert Burks, another virtuoso cameraman, whom Hitchcock found at Warner Brothers in America, would work with him more. As Donald Spoto says in The Art of Alfred Hitchcock, the first shots show a series of round objects at a fairground, a drum beating out an invitation, a carousel, circular tents. The structure of the film is round or cyclic too, and the major image throughout is a circle or ring. There are other rings that could be mentioned in the opening sequence. There are close-ups of open mouths forming circles. There's the bell at the top of the Test Your Strength Tower. There's a target above a black man, above a vat of water, that, should you hit it, drops him in. Two boys throw eggs at him, hitting him in the face, and the whole crowd, all white people, laugh, including a London bobby. Later in the film, the N-word is rather callously used by Corby's manager in a title card. Since the film was made in 1927 and is a product of its time, I don't think these two moments are intended to shock. But on the other hand, One Round Jack does have a black friend amongst his four habitual companions from the carnival. So maybe there's some commentary about racial prejudice here after all. One of those friends is the Barker, who is trying to draw people into the tent to fight One Round Jack. Mabel's ticket-taker stand is set up right by the tent, and she and Bob Corby eye each other when Corby joins the crowd. Corby doesn't want to fight, but Jack urges him when he sees Corby flirting with his girl. There are enough people interested in the various men who have volunteered to fight, one of whom is forced to volunteer by his wife and ends up collapsing in the ring before he's even touched, that we get a close-up of the roll of tickets spinning around as they're being bought, another example of a circle or a ring. When the fight between Jack and Corby begins, Mabel watches through a hole in the tent, and as we heard from Patrick McGilligan, the camera takes her point of view through the hole. At some point in the fight between One Round Jack and Corby, they go to a second round, and we get close-ups of the switch of the sign of round one to the sign of round two. This may be a good point to read the entire transcript between Hitchcock and Truffaut that appears in the Hitchcock-Truffaut book. Truffaut says, "I've seen The Ring several times. It isn't a suspense film and has no criminal ingredients. It's a story about two prize fighters who are in love with the same woman. I like that picture very much." Hitch says, "Yes, that was really an interesting movie. You might say that after The Lodger, The Ring was the next Hitchcock picture. There were all kinds of innovations in it, and I remember that at the premiere, an elaborate montage got a round of applause. It was the first time that had ever happened to me. There were many things in that picture we wouldn't do today. For instance, there was a little party one evening after a boxing match. The champagne is poured out, and it is all bubbly. They drink a toast to the heroine, and then discover she isn't there. She's out with another man. And so the champagne goes flat. In those days, we were very keen on the little visual touches, sometimes so subtle that they weren't even noticed by the public. You remember that the picture started on the fairgrounds. There was a fighter, played by Carl Brisson, and he was called One Round Jack. Truffaut, because he knocked out his opponents in the first round? Hitch, that's right. And in the crowd watching the Barker, there was an Australian, played by Ian Hunter. As the Barker in front of the tent urged the crowd to go in, he had a little flap and could look back over his shoulder to see how the match was progressing. He used a sign to indicate the round number to the people standing outside. We showed volunteer fighters going into the tent and then coming out holding their jaw until Ian Hunter goes in. The seconds were sort of laughing at him, and they didn't even bother to hang up his coat. They just held it, thinking that he would never last more than one round. The match started, and I showed the expressions of the seconds changing. Then we showed the Barker looking in at the match. And at the end of the first round, the Barker took out the card, indicating the round number, which was old and shabby, and they put up number 2. It was brand new. One Round Jack was so good that they'd never got around to using it before. I think this touch was lost on the audience. Truffaut, that was a very nice touch. There were many other visual innovations in the picture. The story was about a triangle, with frequent references to original sin, and I still remember that you used a snake-like bracelet as a symbol in several different ways. Hitch, these things were noticed by the reviewers, and the picture had a succès d'estime, but it was not a commercial hit. This is also the film in which I introduced a few notions that were widely adopted later on. For instance, to show the progress of a prize fighter's career, we showed large posters on the street with his name on the bottom. We show different seasons, summer, autumn, winter, and the name is printed in bigger and bigger letters on each of the posters. I took great care to illustrate the changing seasons, blossoming trees for the spring, snow for the winter, and so on. There are a number of details there in which Hitch's memory is not reliable, but you get the idea. It's one of those shots from Mabel's point of view where we can't see the fighters for the crowd, but we do see a number 4 up for the round, and finally the arm of the referee going up and down counting somebody out. And that someone counted out turns out to be One Round Jack. He doesn't know who he's fought, and we don't know until the man with Corby goes up to Mabel and gives her a business card on which he writes on the back, "Don't fix any other job until I have seen you tonight," and then flips over the card to show James Ware, manager to Bob Corby, heavyweight champion of Australia. Mabel is supposed to give that card to Jack, but she forgets, so that Jack is surprised to see Corby show up that evening. An unpleasant surprise to him. As James Ware and Jack negotiate his job as Corby's sparring partner, Corby takes Mabel aside and gives her the snake-like bracelet. She kisses him for it, and he forcibly kisses her in return, a kiss that she reciprocates. When Jack joins them again, Mabel hides the bracelet, concealing her original sin. It is big enough to slide up her arm, and she covers it when it's at her elbow. Throughout the film, if she's feeling guilty about Jack, she covers that bracelet. Jack doesn't know it exists until he and Mabel are sitting by the river and she tosses a pebble in, causing concentric circles, more rings, and the bracelet falls off her arm into the water. Jack retrieves it, and she explains to him that Corby gave it to her with the excess prize money he received in defeating Jack. So she says, in a way, it's Jack that gave her the bracelet. He takes it and he places it on her finger as if it's a wedding ring. He tells her that he has an audition bout to determine whether he can be Corby's sparring partner, and that he will let her know the result by a telegram. She is back at the carnival, and we get a shot of the telegram kid watching the merry-go-round, his head going around in a circle. And he finally delivers the telegram that tells Mabel that Jack won his fight. With that, they can be married, and attending the wedding are not only Jack's friends from the boxing tent, but various members of the carnival. So we get a scene in which the Siamese twins argue over which side of the aisle they will sit, and we see the giant and the midget arrive together and sit together. Now, it isn't just the carnival workers that attend the wedding. James Ware and Corby are there, and at the post-ceremony dinner, Corby holds out a wishbone to Mabel, and when they tug, he wins. Later, after a sparring match between Jack and Corby, with Corby surrounded by women, he puts a hand on Mabel's shoulder. Jack notices and goes over to a punching bag, where he and we see Corby's face superimposed over the bag, whereupon he hits it so hard he knocks it off its moorings. When Jack complains to James Ware about Corby's flirtations with Mabel, Ware tells him the difference is that he's a champion and you're not. And this is where we get the sequence that Hitchcock described, with Jack's name rising steadily on the boxing card throughout the seasons. Having reached second billing, Jack discusses his training regiment with James Ware, and Ware tells him he should leave his wife behind. But there's a party going on at the same time, in which Corby seems to be getting comfy with Mabel. When Jack goes out to confront them, he finds Mabel alone, but notices that she has a framed portrait of Corby on the piano. So Jack has that one last lead-in fight before he can actually face Corby, and he wins it, returning to his lavish apartment with his four carnival buddies, expecting Mabel to be there, but she's not. So this is the moment where he pours the champagne out, and he tells his friends that they won't drink it until she arrives. And we get a time-lapse shot of the bubbles in the champagne disappearing. In the end, his friends decide to give up and they leave, and we get a nice point-of-view shot as Jack looks out his window to see Mabel arriving. After she enters the apartment, Jack argues with her for not being there to toast his victory. She doesn't even know that he's won. And things really escalate when he zeroes in on that photo of Bob Corby. There's a nice symbolic moment as Jack picks up the photo and flings it across the room so that it shatters the champagne glasses, so that Corby's image shatters the symbol of Jack's victory and his planned celebration with Mabel. The argument then gets quite violent as Jack rips Mabel's dress and yanks the snake bracelet off of her. She retreats, hugging the picture of Bob Corby. So Jack goes to the club where he knows Bob Corby is to confront him, eventually punching him and knocking him down. When he gets home, he finds that the snake bracelet that he left on a table is gone. And Hitchcock presents that to us by showing us the bare table, then fading in a shot of the bracelet, and then fading it out again. He then sees the picture of Bob up on the mantelpiece, and when he goes there, he finds a note from Mabel that reads, "I have gone to people who know how to treat me properly." And so we come to the big fight between Bob Corby and One Round Jack at Albert Hall. And Patrick McGilligan tells us, "The film's climactic Albert Hall match was a triumph of illusion indebted to the recently invented Schuften process, first exploited by Fritz Lang in Metropolis, and which Hitchcock had brought home from Germany as his most valuable souvenir. The new process enabled him to stage scenes in public places without the expense or permission of actually filming there, by blending live action in the foreground against miniatures, photographs, or painted scenery. Many of Hitchcock's most famous special effects were Schuften-style composites, real backgrounds mixed with recreations. Ultimately, The Ring is the most Germanic in style of Hitchcock's silent films, as critic Jonathan Rosenbaum observed, a drama conventional in its storyline, but shot in a dense experimental style. Though in neither scope nor theme as sweeping as Metropolis, The Ring is as dark and velvety as a Fritz Lang epic. So Mabel attends the fight, but she sits on Bob Corby's side in the front row. And in the resulting sequences, it's not a question of whoever wins the fight will win Mabel, but whoever Mabel picks will win the fight. Jack is doing just fine until he notices Mabel in Bob's corner. And soon after that, Bob knocks him down, only being saved by the bell. Back in his corner, his friends try to rouse him by pouring champagne over his head. But it's not the champagne that's going to save him. It's Mabel moving slowly around the ring. She first takes a seat in the neutral corner, where we have a nice scene after Jack is knocked down again. The camera stays with Mabel and the people in the crowd, where everyone except Mabel stands up and starts to put their coats on. But then they notice something in the ring. They take their coats off and they sit again. So we know that Jack has gotten back up. Finally, Mabel moves all the way around to Bob's corner, where he sees her reflection in a pail of water. The last time we saw her reflection was in the river when she lost the bracelet and Jack became aware of the serpent in the garden for the first time. In the next round, it is Bob who sees the empty chair, and soon after, Jack knocks him down. Bob does not get back up. With the fight over and Jack the winner, Mabel takes the snake bracelet off and leaves it there at the ring. The final scene, interestingly enough, is not of Jack and Mabel, but of Bob back in his dressing room. One of his men comes in with the bracelet. He hands it to Bob. Bob tosses it back to him, and the guy goes off with it. Bob, who may be the serpent in the Garden of Eden, has relinquished his hold on the couple. In The Dark Side of Genius, Donald Spoto writes, "At film's end, One Round Jack regains the loyalty of his wife, who has dallied with his champion opponent. But the circular structure of the story and the succession of round objects that act as markers suggest that long, hard efforts will be required in the couple's future." In Alfred Hitchcock, A Brief Life, Peter Aykroyd writes, "Comedy is, in fact, the key tone of The Ring, together with the suspense of which he had become a master. He had made an art out of the nervous stomach. He pinned the butterflies to the wall." As Hitch tells Truffaut, the film did not do all that well at the box office, but the critics were ecstatic. One, quoted by Donald Spoto, said, "This is the most magnificent British film ever made." As I've said, Charles is a grade-A crumb, but it should be noted that he is the only character here who does not attempt a murder. It's therefore appropriate that the book from which I got the short story is a 1960 pocketbook paperback entitled A Butcher's Dozen of Wicked Women, in which Emily Neff gives us a somewhat simplistic, but perhaps most straightforward description of these two women. Apparently, they had one thing in common. They both wanted all or nothing. On the other hand, that's not entirely true. It's Marcia who wants all. Beryl will settle for nothing. I think, with the poison in the coffee itself, that the story implies that Beryl will settle for the ultimate nothing, a murder-suicide. But that's clearly not the case in the episode. So why is it that Beryl is willing to kill Charles instead of trying to kill Marcia? Is it that the whole murder's just been so nicely set up for her? Has her love turned so quickly? Is this Beryl's way of punishing Marcia, letting Marcia think that she has killed Charles? Or, like the story of prisoners getting one for the road or being on the wagon, is all of that just bunkum? In the end, Charles is enough of a grade-A crumb who has caused enough grief to these two women that it becomes a nice little revenge fantasy for the audience, punctuated by a nifty little twist. You're welcome to delve into it further if you'd like. I'm going to leave it at that. Now here's Hitch. He's out of the pillory and ready to give us a quick goodbye in the European version of the outro, which is on my DVD.
"It's good to be free again. Which is more than Beryl Abbott is. You see, she was arrested and paid for her crime. Next time, we shall be back with another story. Good night."
But not so fast. We have to go to the original outro, as provided by Martin Grimes Jr. and Patrick Wickstrom, in the Alfred Hitchcock Presents Companion. It begins the same as the European version, and then I'll take it from there.
"It's good to be free again, which is more than Beryl Abbott is. You see, she was arrested and paid for her crime."
Now, before I return, we shall have the last commercial, One for the Road. And no doubt it will be just as effective as the drink in our story. Alfred Hitchcock Presents Season 2, Stagecoach, and The Ultimate Sinatra, containing the song One for My Baby and One More for the Road, are all available at the Ann Arbor District Library. The Ring is available online. If you would like to contact me about this podcast, please email me at sjoerdma@aadl.org. That's sjoerdsmaa@aadl.org. And please put Hitchcock somewhere in the subject line. Next time, episode 63, The Cream of the Jest, starring Claude Rains and James Gregory. When we return from commercial, Hitch is in the pillory again. My, the sponsor's a sensitive fellow. Well, why don't you tune in next week and see if he has relented? I suspect I shall be here, and we shall have a story as well.
Good night.